Accession number 30419, reel 4.
And I passed through that. They flew me from Cranwell in a jet provost. The jet provost had to go down to Hunting Percival's, which were at Luton, for maintenance, and they put me in it and flew me in it to make sure that everything was all right. I waited. Took my A levels, which I passed, 55% in each, I remember. Went off on holiday with a chum up to Scotland on a walking tour. And we were out of contact with civilization, a place called Craig up in Westeros. But I called in at a post office where we'd organise a post restaurant, and there were two letters, one from my girlfriend, one from my mother. I opened the one from my girlfriend. It said, "You've been selected for Cranwell," and other things. I opened the one from my mother, and I said, she said, "You've been selected for Cranwell, but you'll know that already because you're sure to have opened your girlfriend's letter first." That was quite touching. Anyway, I had to be there the next week, and I had to buy a hat. She said, "You have to have a hat."
What kind of hat?
Well, that's a very good question. It didn't specify what kind of hat, but I soon found out. I had to jump on a train and come back to London. I bought a hat. It was a sort of a pork pie affair. And I was sent a rail pass, and really quite dishevelled. I had extremely long hair. I'd been in the Highlands for 3 weeks. I arrived at Cranwell. More strictly speaking, Grantham Railway Station. There was a flight sergeant waiting for us with a bus, and the discipline started from there. We were herded onto the bus, taken to Cranwell, which is in the middle of Lincolnshire. It's about 15 miles south of, 10 miles, I suppose, south of Lincoln, out in the Fens. Pretty imposing place, bloody great big college building, but we didn't go into the main college building. We were taken to the South Brick Lines, which were airmen's quarters, and we were put in there as flight cadets. Within an hour, they marched us off to the junior mess, to the barber's. I can remember his words at the end of my haircut: "There we are, sir, that's much smarter, isn't it?" I was absolutely scalped. We were all scalped.
Did you guys want some coffee? Were you expecting that, scalping?
I didn't really know what to expect, Cathy, but I should have been, shouldn't I? And the process for the next several weeks was to reduce us to a blob of incomprehending, shocked, non-characterless lumps of flesh that they could then rebuild into what they want us to be.
How did they do that?
Four of us in each of these huts, and there was a mentor from the next entry up who seemed terribly grown up and capable to us, but of course he was only a few months older than we were. We were there for three, it was a 3-year course. We knew that it was going to be a 3-year course. And those first days, you think, how on earth am I going to get through these 3 years? And how am I going to get through 3 nights? Didn't exactly cry into my pillow, but everything that was done to you was demeaning. You had to scrub the floor. You had to get up at crack of dawn. You had to get on the drill square. The senior entries came down and played pranks on you, made you do demeaning things, sing songs, start naked, crawl in the snow. No, it wasn't any snow. It was ruddy cold. they doused you with water pipes, water hoses, that sort of thing. You had to make a fool of yourself. And you could fight back, but if you fought back, it got worse. They then said, here's one who's fighting back. So it was pretty obvious that the thing wasn't to fight back. The thing was to show stoicism and stiff upper lip, which is what they were looking for, that you were able just to grin and bear it. And that showed more character than fighting back.
And was it good-natured or was it nasty?
Some of it was very nasty. There were one or two real sadists.
Because the potential for an abuse of power is...
Yes.
...very huge.
Absolutely. And, of course... Their defence was they were only getting their own back because it had happened to them. But that was called crowing. And we were the crows. And so they would come down from the senior mess for a spot of crowing after dinner when they'd had a few. So it was just when you were trying to get your drill kit ready for the next morning, 6 o'clock, you were put through this business. It was pretty awful, but you coped. The drill instructors were extraordinary. I mean, this was 1959. National service had not finished. The intakes had finished, but the national service people were in their last year or so. I think the last entry was 58. And so they'd had lots of practice. And our Flight Sergeant Ault was a hell of a character. He had a little brush. He was a big man. Looked a lot like Andrew Flintoff, the England cricketer. And he had a bottle brush moustache, so he was called Bog Brush. And he, Bog Ault, and he was extraordinary. We all realise what a great bloke he was, and underneath his gruffness and all the rest of it, he had a heart of gold. But he put you through it on the drill square.
In what way?
Well, he would, obviously, in getting you to stand up straight, and I need a lot of getting to stand up straight. 6 foot 6, you stoop. And, of course, I wasn't cut out for the drill square, really, and he knew it. He wasn't used to having 6 foot 6 beam poles on his drill square. So you were bashed into shape by him. But then he had a tremendous wit and sense of humour. There was a little guy called Bill Wood, later called Blind Bill Wood, because his eyesight wasn't very good, but he became a Canberra pilot. He wore glasses. And he had a coronation medal. Oh, Mr. Wood, what were we doing then? What's our medal for? Singing at the flock coronation, Flight Sergeant. Well, of course, he came in for all kinds of ribaldry for that. There was a big Welshman, Frank Hoare, who became leader of the Red Arrows later on. Very Welsh. Oh, Mr. Hoare, what's wrong with these? What have you been doing to these buttons? I heard on them, Flight Sergeant, he said in Welsh accent. Of course, that brought the house down, but you weren't allowed to laugh. If you laughed, you were on defaulters. So, yes, which meant that you would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go and do drill before everybody else did any drill. So you tried to keep off that. And if you transgressed in any way, see me after! And you knew if he was seeing you after, you were on defaulters. And going on defaulters meant being marched in front of the flight commander, flight lieutenant. I can't remember too much about him, except that he smoked like a chimney. He always had a 200-pack of Rothmans king size on his desk. And the charge would be read out. You'd be given a sentence. And you're on defaulters, maybe for a few days, maybe for a couple of weeks. And, of course, if you were on defaulters, you were at risk of being put on defaulters again. And there were some guys who were serial defaulters. And they were usually the ones who left early, because they didn't have the knack of cooperating with the discipline. So the first weeks were all doing your kit and square bashing and demeaning tasks, nothing really to do with flying or anything else, but just basic drill training.
Can you tell me a bit about that, about even things like preparing your kit and what the expectations were, what kit there was prepared and what the expectations were?
Yes. On the second day we were there, we went and drew kit from the stores. And that comprised a battle dress, boots, gaiters, shirts, the whole lot, string vest, tie, beret, overalls for dirty work, all that kind of stuff, socks, underpants, drawers, cotton, cellular, they were called. And then you had to take all this back to the hut. I was in trouble straight away. They didn't have any kit for six foot sixers. So I did the first two or three weeks of my training in civvies, which was awful. You wanted to be like everybody else. You stood out like a sore thumb in your civvies.
Yeah, especially at the moment when you really wanted
yes,
to be like everybody else.
Yes. And so I had to be measured, and they got me some special stuff in. And then you had to arrange this in the cupboards. You had to keep your bed space absolutely as required by the flight sergeant, which meant that your bed had to be, all the blankets had to be folded right, and everything had to be straight. Everything in your cupboard had to be absolutely folded flat and in a line. All your socks had to be done up properly.
Okay. And how would you do up your socks?
You had to learn. I mean, the mentor told you about that. That was the reason for the mentor being there. He'd gone through it and he could tell you what was what. Yeah, I mean, if you didn't, you know, you take one sock and fold it inside the other, so there's a pair with a nice ring. You had to learn to do that. I'd never done it. I mean, lots of people hadn't done these things. Lots of people hadn't even cut their own nails. I mean, there were people from all backgrounds in this hut. The son of a Scottish miner, the son of an Air Vice Marshal. And everything in between, I was going to say, but of course we were all, didn't matter what background we came from, except one poor bloke called Fazakerly, who was from Liverpool, and the flight sergeant was a Geordie, and the Geordies and the Liverpudlians, and another guy called Coulson, who supported the wrong rugby league side and used to come in for all kinds of stick because the flight sergeant supported another rugby league side. You learned all kinds of things about other people. I'd been middle class, Walton-on-Thames, Kingston Grammar School, and I was pitched into this. Wonderful, wonderful. And very, very good for me. If I'd gone to a university, I'm sure I would have come off the rails. But here I was being given a basic training in life. That's the way I look at it now. Maybe at the time I thought differently. But I had a stroke of luck in that, number one, I got in the hockey side. You wanted to know more
So
you had to keep your kit in order. You had to keep the floor so you could see your face in it. There was a coke stove in the middle. You had to keep this coke stove polished, but of course it had to be lit to keep us warm. You had to bull your boots. The boot was issued in its virgin state, and you had to virtually melt a whole tin of boot polish onto it with the back of a hot spoon to build up I've still got them in the attic. Build up a shine of boot polish on the toe. Yeah, I mean,
extraordinary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's amazing. Had to polish your buttons. You had a button stick and Brasso, and you used to have to polish the buttons. No fingerprints. Got a fingerprint on the button. That was a week's defaulters. You had to blanco the kit. Blue blanco, which is a kind of a powder, on your belt, your webbing belt. Oh, and you had to keep your rifle clean, which meant you have to take it to pieces, clean the bolt, clean the bolt and pull through the barrel. Every drill parade, they would inspect the barrels of your rifle. Your rifle had to be padlocked to your bed, and woe betide, I mean, if you lost your rifle, the IRA was, they were always saying the IRA will come and get your rifles. Well, I shouldn't think the IRA knew where Cranwell was, but that was a threat. You had to do all that, and of course you had to have a haircut every week, I think, they cut your hair. Cap badge had to be clean, because there was metal in that. And you had to turn out in the morning, every morning, in first-class order. That was what you had to do, and it was a full-time employment. Then you had to wash your socks and your underpants, and I think they took your shirts away, but I can remember washing other stuff and drying it out. You had to sew your buttons on. You learnt pretty quick.
How did you feel about this suddenly becoming your life?
I felt pretty... I have to say that my problem throughout my service career was I had more imagination than most. And what last thing you wanted was imagination. And so I could imagine, I was doubting whether I had actually made the right decision. I had a girlfriend, I must have had two girlfriends at the time, because one took pity on me. I think she got the impression that I was on national service. And she kept on writing and sending me magazines to support me through this. It actually helped quite a lot. And I suppose I was thinking, what have I done? There wasn't an aeroplane in sight. And there wasn't going to be for a year, except that we did some navigation training, which was appalling. And so it was a sense of shock. I was in shock. And feeling pretty uncomfortable with myself, because there I was, 6'6", no hair. I looked awful. I've got a picture of me. The picture, I'll come on to that. The commandant had to go and give out the prizes. I got a letter from my headmaster. Dear Annett, somewhat to my surprise, I found that you have won the English prize. Which was a surprise to everyone. So I had to go to speech day. And I think it must have been October. It was pretty soon. So I was sent. And by this time I got a uniform. I had two excursions, that's right. I was sent down to Farringdon Road in London to be measured for my officer pattern kit, my number ones. I got back to London for a night. Couldn't believe it. But of course I was hopeless because I had no hair. I was still this beaten down lump of idiot, really. I went to see my girlfriend, but she wasn't very interested in me anymore because I was flat out, really. And when I went down in my new officer pattern kit with the Air Commodore, Air Commodore he was, I was told by the flight commander he smokes Craven A, and I went as his adjutant. So I had to make sure I had Craven A cigarettes to give him, and I went in this big black car with the commandant of Cranwell, for goodness sake, to the speech day. I've got a picture of me. I look terrible. I look as if I'm in absolute shock. Come back to that word again. But I got through it, got through speech day, collected my prize, and went back up to Cranwell. After about 8 weeks, I suppose I had my first outing on the hockey side. I played hockey, I was a goalkeeper. And we went to either Nottingham or Sheffield University, I can't quite remember which, but there were girls, and we played hockey. And that was really the first reconnection with ordinary life.
A moment of normalcy.
Normalcy, yeah. Because the other two outings weren't normal at all. Anyway, there we are. After, I suppose, December, we came home for Christmas. And...
So how long did you been at Let Me Do Something Hell by Christmas? When did you go to Cranwell?
Went to Cranwell on September the 3rd. And so it was October, November, 3 months. September, October, November, nearly 4 months in 59, yeah.
Okay, so the initial weeks are square bashing and
yes.
Cricket, and what happens after that? What are you learning after that?
You start to do a bit of Air Force, induction into Air Force law, Air Force ways and meat, and we were taught how to hold a knife and fork and spoon.
Really?
How to eat at table.
Oh, yeah, maybe I can dig it wrong with
these. Every week we used to have to get dressed up in our best kit, and we had a dining in night, and that was a formal affair, three courses and all the rest of it, and all the RAF rigmarole. Mr. Vice, the Queen, the guy who sat at the end of the table was Mr. Vice, and he had to stand up and say, "Gentlemen, the Queen," so he had the loyal toast. That started pretty early. The flight commander, chain smoking is Rothman's, taught us Air Force etiquette, how to leave a calling card. We had to go and leave calling cards at the assistant commandant's house.
Is there a process to that?
Yes. There was a process to everything. Everything was was a disciplined approach to life. And everybody did the same. That's forces life. It's only occurred to me now. Because my kids know nothing at all. I suppose they have their own disciplines, their own norms, ways of doing things. But here the idea was to knock us all down and then build us up as RAF officers. And RAF officers go and leave calling cards.
How do you do it? How do you leave a calling card?
You go and knock on the door, and the batman opens the door, and you put it in the tray. And you have to have your hat on, civilian kit with a hat on, and you turn around and go away again. Simple as that. But then, after a while, you get invited to a soiree at the assistant commandant's, where I can remember the difficulty of balancing a plate of spaghetti bolognese and a glass of fizzy white wine and a fork and talking to the assistant commandant's wife all at the same time. And, of course, you had to get changed every evening. You couldn't slouch. Every evening you had to get out of uniform and into civilian kit, and it had to be all civilian kit. There was a thing called a warrant officer's change, which was that you left on your blue shirt and just put a jacket on over it. But you had to change everything. If you got caught in the same socks that you were wearing in the day, I think you'd probably keep the same underwear. But shirt and tie and jacket and trousers and shoes all had to be different from what you were wearing in the day. One of the things in the mess, officers were expected to change for dinner. I suppose they were in the posh houses of the day, so you had to do it in the mess.
So you were learning a lot about etiquette.
Yes.
And what else?
Air Force law, we started quite early. And then principles of flight, we must have started quite early. And then, it must have been in that first term, we were selected off into humanities stream and science stream. And because I had three A levels in French, Spanish and English literature, I was a cert for the humanities stream, and there was a new director of studies and the new commandant who together dreamt up the idea, wouldn't it be good if we enhanced the Cranwell education syllabus? Because it was pretty much a secondary modern syllabus, plus, of course, avionics, navigation, and all the air-related subjects. But you did it was wonderful. We did electronics. I remember making a wireless at some stage. We did metalworking again and all that kind of thing. So the WAGs used to call us Sleaford Tech because Cranwell was near Sleaford. And the Army and the Navy guys used to call it Sleaford Tech. It was technical training. So they wanted to enhance this. And half a dozen of us were selected to take an external degree at London University in humanities, and a dozen of us to take the Associated Fellowship of the Royal Aeronautical Society exams, AFRAS, which was degree status. So, Cathy, on top of everything else, we started a university course.
And obviously you had enough just getting your boots run.
Whilst we were trying to get our boots done. And everything. And it was absolutely, it was marvellous because I had made the right decision after all, because I was getting paid, I was kept warm and dry, I was being fed, and I was going to learn to fly at some stage, and I was taking the degree after all.
And your brain was being fed.
And what?
Your brain was being fed.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, so that helped tremendously. So I started doing that. But could that have been that first term? Because in the first term we were also doing, of course, we were doing training with the RAF regiment.
What did that involve?
That was escape and evasion. Gentlemen, there are killer dogs. There are killer dogs in East Germany. And I can remember that we were trained to avoid killer dogs in East Germany. What you do is you wait for them to spring at you, you grab their front paws and push them apart as fast as you can.
Is that the trick?
It's the trick. Fortunately, we never had any practice at that, but that was the theory.
That's quite worth knowing, though.
Yes.
If you
were ever leapt at by a killer dog, grab its front paws and do the splits with it.
Okay.
And we were... and how to survive in all climates. Flying boots are designed so that you take your knife, which you always carry when you're flying, and you cut off the upper part and you've got a pair of black civilian shoes. That sort of thing. That was the RAF regiment. They came into play.
Can you remember anything else?
We had dinghy drills to do, that's right. We went to Hull. Was it Hull or perhaps somewhere a bit nearer? One of those fishing places up on the East Coast to be dumped in a swimming pool and got into dinghies. I don't know why we went that far. But there wasn't a swimming pool at this stage at Cranwell, that's right. So we had to go and find a swimming pool. So we did dinghy drills. We did, and in Easter 1960, we did a survival camp in the Cairngorms, which is a story in itself. So we'll come to that later, perhaps. But so all that was going on in parallel. All kinds of things were going on in parallel. All kinds of things, and I took French. We had to do military studies as one of the subjects for the general degree. We could then choose, and I chose French and economics. So I finally started to learn what economics was all about. I was the only guy doing economics. There were three or four of us doing French. and everybody did military studies.